Johnson Bank v. Korbakas. Mr. Solacek.
May it please the Court, my name is Albert Solacek from the law firm of Howard Solacek & Weber, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant. Your Honors, one of the primary issues before this Court, if not the primary issue before this Court...
Before we get to any issues, I have a question about subject matter jurisdiction in this case. The defendant is a partnership. Of what state are its partners citizens?
Illinois, Your Honor.
How do we know that in this record? The reason I ask this is because your jurisdictional statement is defective. It alleges the residence of the partners, and residence is not citizenship. And the appellee's jurisdictional statement says it's complete and correct. Well, the Supreme Court has told us that allegations of residence lead straight to dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. So we went to the record and looked. All the documents in the record speak exclusively of residence. There is no allegation of citizenship that I could find. So how do we know of what state they're citizens?
Your Honor, I must confess I did not look at the jurisdictional issue in light of the fact that it was not raised, and I believe
the first issue in every case.
I appreciate that, and I believe jurisdiction was raised in the complaint and
yes,
alleged, and was
residence was alleged in the complaint.
Well, not to pick up on the last argument, but it may appear, Your Honor, that the appellee and the appellant in this case may also have to file a motion under Rule 10 to support
this. No, this is not a Rule 10 question. Take a look at 28 U.S.C. 1653, which provides that pleadings may be amended even on appeal to show jurisdiction. So it may be that you need to propose an amendment under 1653 if, indeed, that can be done accurately. But, of course, sometimes when the allegation is of residence, that's because a truthful allegation of citizenship would show no diversity.
And
so this is not a pro forma question, changing the word residence to citizenship. This requires finding out the party's citizenship, which is to say their domicile, and making accurate allegations.
I appreciate that, Your Honor, and the citation, and obviously that any statement made to this court on my behalf would be accurate and truthful. And if it's not the case, I would so indicate to the court. Hoping that jurisdiction is met, I would submit that the primary issue before this court is the lower court's determination that the appellant, Johnson Bank, did not reasonably rely on the audit involved in this case. The appellant is appreciative that under Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 52A, that there must be, and the standard is, a clearly erroneous standard applies as to the lower court's determination. The appellee, through its brief, has virtually cited or stated that this standard can virtually never be met. Although we appreciate the burdens associated with this section or this standard, we believe that the lower court was violating and did erroneously make its decision in this case. And I say that, Your Honors, because I believe very importantly, you must look to the record, and the record consists of Thomas Wolfe, a banker of 20 years of experience, testifying that what he did was appropriate, what he did was within the standards, internal standards of the bank, what he did was in the standards.
Even if the audit violated some principles of accounting, it gave all the information, didn't it, to Johnson Bank? So they knew all the facts. Maybe some things were mistakenly classified, but didn't they know all the facts?
No, Your Honor.
What didn't they know?
Critically important, what they did.
Something like the contra liability, and it shouldn't have been a contra liability. Sure. But there was a footnote which explained exactly what it was. It was a claim against Pearson. So Wolf knew if he read the footnote. So what is an actual fact that was concealed from the bank as a result of, you know, GKC's auditing?
Well, on the contra liability, for just one moment, if I may, Professor Rittenberg, our expert from the University of Wisconsin, I'm sorry?
Wolf knew all the facts. He could say, yeah, this is a claim for $1 million, and if they win the case, great, and if they lose, the $1 million evaporates, right? He knew that. That's obvious.
Well,
care what an expert says.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree in this sense, and I appreciate the comments by the court.
I don't think you want to quibble with the characterization question. My question is the same as Judge Posner's.
Okay.
Are there any facts that were concealed as opposed to quibbles about characterization?
Yes, Your Honor. The audited financial statement showed Brandon to have increasing sales. In fact, it was having decreasing sales. The audit showed that it had increased in sales from the previous year. In fact, in previous years, I should say, Your Honor, and in fact, there were decreasing sales. The audited financial statement assumed inventory units at $2.40 per unit. Mr. Gershenson, on behalf of the defendant appellee auditor, acknowledged at trial that this was an incorrect number. It was not accurate, and he tried to make up on it. The inventory, Your Honor, was misstated, not only for that reason, but because what was employed by the auditor was the retail sales method in determining what the inventory was. Obviously, one problem was this was not a retail sales business. But putting that aside, Your Honors, what it didn't do is the retail sales method took the assumptions concerning the inventory and built upon them, rather than, in fact, doing an accounting of the inventory in place. Also, what affected the inventory and was a misstatement was that when the Brandon moved its premises, entire movement of all of its inventory from one facility to another facility, there was not an accurate accounting. There wasn't measures taken that appropriately showed that, in fact, the inventory that was moved got to the other place. So we had a misstatement of inventory. There's a whole myriad of other issues that were raised by Professor Rittenberg in his statement and in his assessment of the audit. And in fact, it was testified by the professor.
Well,
that
this Gershenson, according to Judge Palmer, testified that he did test the $2.40 overhead cost figure, and that he also, now, rather than simply relying on Brandon's reported estimate, now, that's a finding by Judge Palmer. Is that clearly erroneous?
It is clearly erroneous.
Believed Gershenson?
Gershenson stated in the record that number was incorrect. He said he may have tested it, but he said the number was incorrect. And that was not disputed.
Well, he may know now that it was incorrect. Did he know it was incorrect when he prepared the audit?
Yes, Your Honor. He assumed he could use that number, but the number was wrong and was known to him to be wrong.
Why did he assume he could use it if he knew it was wrong?
Your Honor, I would be speculating as to it.
Well, wasn't he asked, surely? Didn't you ask him at the trial?
He said that he knew it was wrong.
And then so why did he use it?
Your Honor, I can't recall, to be honest with you, what his explanation may have been. But clearly,
Seems to have convinced the audit,
Your Honor, an audit is not to be something that we need to know why he did one thing or the other. An audit is a third party coming in, looking at the financial information of a company, and then saying that the financial information is true and correct and is appropriately accounted for within GAAP. That statement was made by the auditor. When an audit is then used, it's submitted to third parties. The third party that here, the auditor, sent the audit directly to the bank, knowing that the bank would rely on the audit. I may not be able to explain to the court why the auditor did what he did. Maybe the auditor was taking a shortcut that he shouldn't have taken. But I can say to the court that the audit was incorrect. It painted a picture of a financial situation of Brandon which didn't exist. And
Of course, you're mixing in, of course, things like what Judge Easterbrook called the characterization issue, the contra liability, and so on. So how much of your the points you made, the $2.40 and the sales falling rather than rising and so on, how much of the erroneous picture of Brandon's assets and income was due to these you regard as factual errors by the auditor, as opposed to the characterization?
And I don't want to mislead
like the million, you know, the contra liability, $1 million. Okay, big number. Now, how big are this, the 240 and the... I didn't see a breakdown of what could be attributed to facts concealed in the audit that Brandon, that you wouldn't have any particular reason to question, and characterizations where you have the facts and the auditor thinks it should be placed in this accounting pigeonhole and maybe mistakenly.
Your Honor, I don't want to mislead the court, but my recollection was that it was a close to it. For example, with the inventory, it was a close to a $2 million number. With the cost of goods sold, which was also done inappropriately according to Professor Rittenberg, it was also a substantial number. There was an accounting for prepaid expenses, which was a substantial number. One of the exhibits that was submitted with the pretrial order were all of the professionals' expert opinions, and I believe that Professor Rittenberg did address that and did state an economic or a dollar amount as to those various items that he found.
So you think that's in the record?
I believe so, Your Honor. Your Honor, I come back again to the reliance.
I find troublesome. You seem to think, I got the impression from your brief, you think an auditor's role is to advise a company, a bank, on the commercial reasonableness of dealing with the audited firm. Is it reasonable for the bank to, and that's not the auditor's duty. The auditor is just supposed to give a picture. And then you, the banker, have to make a judgment. Are you going to keep lending money to this company? The auditor can't tell you that.
No.
The auditor doesn't tell you, you know, don't lend to these people. They're on the way out.
Right. What one is to do...
You had a lot of information, both from the audit and from Wolf's own knowledge of this banking relationship.
What Wolf testified to, Your Honor...
You use the audit as kind of insurer. Once you think the audit is imperfect, you can keep throwing money at Brandon and then recoup from the auditor.
Your Honor...
I think auditing is very dangerous.
Well...
One slip and, you know, owe the bank all this money.
Your Honor, if I may address that.
How much are you seeking in damages?
Your Honor, the damages were... The complaint alleged what the bank lost, which was over $11 million. However, as to the damages, which were commented by the court...
What are you seeking in damages? If we reversed, what would you be asking for in damages?
A minimum of $2,700,000+.
And a maximum of?
Another $1,011,000. About $4 million would be the maximum, I believe, Your Honor. I take that back. Possibly you could consider one of the theory on damages that we did advance, which provided for $6.2 million. after the receipt of the audit, for the rest of the period from May of 1999 to the end of 1999, Brandon received $6.2 million into their account at Johnson Bank. I'm afraid I've gone over, but maybe on my rebuttal I'll address it. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Selichek. Mr. Sullivan?
May it please the Court, Peter Sullivan on behalf of the defendant, appellee George Krabakis and Company. I think at the outset it's important to note that this case comes before the Court following a judgment.
In response to Judge Easterbrook's question, I mean, these are your guys.
Yes. It's my understanding that citizenship of a limited part of a limited liability partnership is determined by the residency, the citizenship of each of the partners.
The citizenship of its partners.
The citizenship
That's
of each
problem.
Of its partners.
All the papers seem to talk about residence rather than citizenship.
And the citizenship of each partner is determined, as I understand it, by their place of residence.
No. It is determined by their domicile.
Okay.
Which differs.
Right?
As
That's
you
true.
As a lawyer have to know that it differs.
I do know
that. Or
You're
at
right.
least it can differ from their residence.
In this case, the facts are that the domiciles and the residence are the same. I understand that is not readily apparent from the record because I was going to point to the pleadings, and I know Judge Pallmeyer issued an order early on in this case directing that the complaint be amended to specifically allege citizenship. And the complaint was amended to comply with that order. And I know that we filed an answer admitting the residence. You're correct. The domicile was not specifically alleged.
Well, now I'm confused. Did the amended complaint allege domicile?
I believe the word was...
alleged citizenship.
I have to go back and look at it. I apologize. But I know... I think it alleged residence, Judge. I don't believe it. I think it used the word residence, not the word, quote, domicile or the word, quote, citizen. But I would have to go back and allege. I know we admitted the allegations on that issue. I will discuss this with Mr. Solacek afterward and discuss if it is not properly done, an amended pleading and response under 28 U.S.C. 1653. It's important to understand that this is not an appeal from a motion to dismiss or a summary judgment. This is an appeal from a bench trial.
And it was from a trial.
It's a clearly...
So Mr. Solacek has said there was actual concealment. There were statements in the audit which were false and misleading. For example, now one that one is, you know, inventory was overvalued and sales trend was misstated. Accounts receivable were falsely labeled as prepaid expenses. Those are three. So could you comment on those?
As to the sales, his contention is that there was about $7 million of the gross sales figure on the income statement. The top of the income statement is a gross sales figure. Approximately $7 million of that gross sales represented gross sales by a sublicensee of Brandon called Midwest Cadre. Brandon was sublicensing its rights under various licensing agreements with the NBA, et cetera, to put labels on children's clothing so it makes the clothing a lot more valuable and you're able to sell it for a higher price. Midwest Cadre was performing a lot of the functions that led to putting that product to market, and Brandon was sublicensing to them.
But its sales weren't Brandon's sales.
There was a dispute at trial, okay? Professor Rittenberg said it shouldn't be considered Brandon sales. My expert said it should be considered Brandon sales. But it's sort of like the contra liability issue because there was a specific footnote disclosure on this issue in note 1 of the audit report in the second paragraph. It specifically disclosed that the subcontractor reports the sales to the company and remits the proceeds net of the agreed-upon cost. In 1998, sales of adult product amounted to $7,320,000. And in cross-examination of Mr. Wolf at trial, he acknowledged that he had read that note. I mean, after all, how can you say you're going to rely on a financial statement if you haven't read the financial statement? He acknowledged that he had read it. He acknowledged he understood the meaning of that was that $7.3 million of the total gross sales figure on the income statement, which is $19,096,000, represented sales from this subcontractor. So to suggest that the bank was in any way misled by this sales issue or this contra-liability issue, we argued quite strenuously at trial that they could not have been in any way misled by it. Now, the inventory issue is a little bit different because that's their contention was that inventory was overstated. On the balance sheet, it showed inventory at $7 million. Professor Rittenberg said that the auditor didn't properly perform audit tests on inventory. Our experts strongly disagreed with that. Mr. Gershenson strongly disagreed with that. I disagree.
Gershenson did say he did the test. What you're saying, he did proper audit tests for inventory value, but that he came up with the wrong figure. He knew it was the wrong figure.
I respectfully submit that that's a complete misrepresentation of the record. Complete misrepresentation of the record. No such admission was made by Mr. Gershenson. Mr. Gershenson explained at trial the test that he performed to justify his use of that $2.40 number, and that in his opinion it was appropriate and in compliance with generally accepted auditing standards. And our expert agreed with that. Understood that there is an expert dispute in this case on the issue of whether the audit was or was not done in accordance with the standard of care. That was a fact issue that the judge concluded she did not need to decide because there were so many other issues in this case that the bank failed to meet its burden of proof on.
What about the prepaid expenses, the accounts receivable being described as prepaid expenses?
That was a subject of dispute disputed expert testimony on both sides. And of course, on our side, it's our expert, Mr. Brenner, and Gershenson.
Would an expert actually testify that accounts receivable are prepaid expenses?
No. No.
So what was the dispute over?
Whether there was adequate support for a particular item that was included in prepaid expense.
Was it prepaid, you mean?
Right.
So there's a dispute over whether it'd been prepaid?
It was, as I recall, there was a supplier of cloth to Brandon that had issued a very large credit to Brandon that Brandon could use to offset any purchases in the future. And I forget the exact numbers that were involved, but the question was when under that type of a scenario, should this be treated as a prepaid expense or should this be treated as an account receivable, I believe was the issue. But I would point out again that prepaid expense was a specific line item on the balance sheet. There was a note disclosure regarding prepaid expense. I think it's also important to point out that this audit contains a note disclosure that there were $1.8 million of errors in previous audits, not performed by my client. And so when the bank receives this audit, they're on knowledge of a number of things that is just a clear red flag signal that there are problems with this company. And at that point in time, at the time the bank has received this audit, they already have $10 million loaned to Brandon. And the as-of date of the audit is 12/31/98. At that point in time, there was about $9.4 million total debt. So in the four-month interim between the year-end, 12/31/98, and the time they received the audit, the debt has already gone up by $600,000. If you were to perform a borrowing-based calculation based on the audit, there's no room left to loan money. They're all tapped out. And yet they go and they loan an additional $500,000 in May of 1999, most of which, by the way, is used to pay the bank right back. There was a $195,000 negative balance in Brandon's checking account in on, I believe it's May 19 of 2000, the day before a large advance is taken under the new $500,000 increase, and that advance goes right to fix that, cure that negative balance in the checking account.
What was GKC's audit fee to Brandon? Was it Brandon that paid? The bank did.
Brandon paid, correct. The bank did not pay, so that couldn't be an element of damages. I believe it was
$25,000. About. All right. I'm just curious.
Right. And one issue that I do think is important to understand is it's obviously a clear error question as to whether the judge was clearly erroneous in finding that the bank did not actually rely on the audit, whether the judge was clearly erroneous in finding that the bank did not reasonably rely on the audit, even if it was actual reliance, whether the judge was clearly erroneous in finding no causation, and whether the judge was clearly erroneous in finding that they didn't adequately prove their damage theories. They got to get over four clearly erroneous hurdles here in order to prevail in this appeal, and I respectfully submit the evidence in the record supports the judge's ruling on each one of those issues. The duty issue is a little bit different because it's sort of part a legal issue as to whether an auditor owes a duty to a bank in this situation when there's an additional advance in July of 1999, and whether that's a substantially similar transaction under Section 552, I forget the subpart, of the restatement, which I think is a very important issue because the record was quite clear that my client had no knowledge that the bank was going to use this audit, not just for trying to figure out what to do with its existing $10 billion indebtedness, but to go and loan another $500 in May and then another $500 in July. There's no evidence in the record whatsoever that we had any knowledge of that. And the restatement rule says you can't just take an audit and use it for whatever the heck you want. I mean, you could exaggerate and say, does that mean you can take an audit and loan $50 million when there's no possible justification for that based on the audit? Well, here we have an additional $500,000 loaned in July of 1999, and the trial court ruled in part a fact question and part a legal question. The fact question is that a substantially similar transaction to the $10 million of debt that existed as of April 30 of 1999? As to that issue, the judge ruled it wasn't, and I believe that that's a clearly erroneous standard of review on that issue, and there's clearly support for that ruling. Then, of course, is the legal issue as to whether an auditor owes a duty with respect to a not substantially similar transaction. That would be a legal issue, and I believe the Compass Bank case that we cited in Section 552 of the restatement strongly support the judge's legal conclusion in that regard.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Solichak, you had no time, but we'll give you a minute if you'd like to rebut.
I'm sorry, I thought I had 2 minutes left.
No, your red light went on, extinguishing your rebuttal.
I apologize.
It's okay. You can have...
That's okay. Your Honor, I want to point out to the court, and I think it's critically important, on the reasonable reliance. You had Mr. Wolf testifying that he relied, straight out. You had Professor Rittenberg testifying that...
The judge didn't have to believe Mr. Wolf.
I'm sorry?
The judge didn't have to believe Wolf.
No, she didn't have to, but she didn't say that she didn't. In fact, she said when she ruled that Mr. Wolf could not testify as an expert as to value, she acknowledged he was an expert in the banking industry and had 20 years of experience. She never challenged one statement made by Mr. Wolf and contradicted it in her decision. Mr. Wolf testified uncontradicted. Professor Rittenberg testified that what Mr. Wolf did was appropriate and that's how you deal with an audit, uncontradicted. There was no expert witness. There was no witness supported, advanced by the defendant to controvert the testimony. And that's why we say this was a clearly erroneous standard that was met, because the judge didn't have any evidence. The judge didn't like what happened here. She didn't like that Brandon was a highly leveraged company from square one. It was. That's why the USDA gave a guarantee.
On the specific points that Mr. Sullivan made about Gershenson's testimony about the inventory valuation?
Yes, my belief of the record would support that Gershenson acknowledged that the $2.40 per unit was wrong. He tried to explain it. He tried to give some kind of rationale for it, but he didn't deny that it was wrong. Also, it's important that the Mr. Sullivan indicated to you, counsel indicated to you, that, oh, Wolf knew about this $7 million. The cost of goods sold on Exhibit 14 in the Statement of Income and Retained Earnings shows a number of $15,911,208. That was more than $2 or $3 million, I don't have the exact number, of the previous audit. This showed an increase in sales. It wasn't footnoted. It wasn't negated. It showed an increase in sales. The bank, on April 29th, had a loan committee meeting and approved the loan from $6 million to $6.5 million. It was conditional approval based upon receipt of the audit. Mr. Wolf said he would not make any further advances without the audit. The audit comes in on May 1st, 2 days after the meeting. The audit shows retained earnings that the company had, collateral to cover the bank's obligations, shows that Brandon is increasing in sales, therefore a viable company, and shows that the there was inventory to cover it, sales were increasing, and shows it was profitable. Professor Rittenberg says...
Okay, we'll have to terminate.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Okay, well, thank you to both counsel.